16. A Troika of Liars. The head of the Department of Special Assignments was near the end of his report to Minister Abakumov. It dealt with the timing of lethal acts abroad in the coming year, 1950, and who exactly should carry them out. The program of political assassinations had been approved in principle by Stalin before he went on vacation. Abakumov, a tall man made taller by elevator shoes, with black hair slicked back from his brow, was wearing the shoulder boards of a colonel general. He sat with his elbows planted masterfully on his imposing desk. He was large, but not fat. He took care of his figure and even played tennis from time to time. His eyes were quick, shrewd, and suspicious. He dictated the necessary corrections to the department head, who hastened to write them down. Abakumov's office, though not quite a hall, was more than just a room. There was a disused marble fireplace and a tall mirror. The ceiling was high and moulded. Nymphs and amoretti chased each other across it, and there was a chandelier. The minister had ordained that all should remain as before, except that the green parts were painted over, since that was a colour he couldn't stand. There was a balcony door, bolted and barred winter and summer. Nor were the big windows looking out on the square ever opened. Timepieces on view were one grandfather clock with an exquisite case, one chiming mantelpiece clock with a figurine, one electric wall clock of the sort seen at railway stations. These were somewhat at odds as to the time, but Abakumov was never misled because he also had two gold watches on his person, one on his hairy wrist and one, with an alarm, in his pocket. Offices in this building grew larger as occupants rose in rank. So did desks. So did the conference tables with their dark blue, scarlet, or blush pink cloths. But nothing grew with such zealous haste as the portraits of the inspirer and organizer of victories. Even in the offices of simple investigators he was portrayed much larger than life, and in Abakumov's office the leader of mankind had been painted by a member of the school of Kremlin realists on a canvas 5 meters high, full length from his shoes to his marshal's cap, ablaze with all his decorations, which in real life he never wore, most of them conferred on himself by himself, some few the gift of kings and presidents, no longer, however, including the Yugoslav orders, which had been skilfully dabbed out with paint matching his tunic. It appeared, however, that Abakumov found this 5 meter image inadequate, that he felt a need to be inspired at every minute by the sight of the counter-espionage agent's best friend, even when he had his eyes on his papers, for on his desk he also had an upright slab of rhodonite with a bas-relief of Stalin. Furthermore, a portrait of Abakumov's immediate superior, a simpering person in pince-nez, was roomily accommodated on one wall. When the head of the death department had left, three men entered in single file, and in single file they crossed the patterned carpet. Deputy Minister Selivanovsky, the head of the Special Technology Department, Major General Oskolupov, and the chief engineer of that department, Engineer Colonel Yakonov. In strict order of seniority, and with a meticulous show of respect for the occupant of the office, they marched forward in step, so that only Selivanovsky's feet were heard. Selivanovsky, a lean old man with close-cropped grizzled hair, wearing a grey suit of unmilitary cut, occupied a unique position among the minister's 10 deputies. He was in charge not of security officers or investigators, but of communications and delicate secret technology. This meant that his master's anger was less frequently visited on him, in conference and in ministerial orders. He was more at ease in this office than the others, and promptly sat down in the overstuffed leather armchair facing Abakumov's desk. With Selivanovsky seated, Oskolupov was front man. Yakonov stood close behind him, apparently trying to conceal his bulk. Abakumov saw Oskolupov thus suddenly revealed to him, perhaps for the third time in his life, and found the man rather to his liking. Oskolupov was on the plump side, his neck strained at the collar of his tunic, and his chin, obsequiously drawn in, would soon be a double one. His leathery face, more heavily pockmarked than that of the leader himself, was the simple, honest face of a man who carries out orders, not that of a know-it-all intellectual with crackpot ideas. Abakumov squinted over Askolupov's shoulder at Yakonov and asked who he was.
Me?
Askolupov was dismayed to find himself unrecognized.
Me?
Yakonov said, bending slightly sideways. He drew in his rebellious soft belly as best he could. For all his efforts, it kept growing, and his big blue eyes were blank as he presented himself.
Yes, you,
the minister said sniffily.
Marfino's your outfit, is it? Right. Sit down.
They sat. The minister picked up a ruby-red plexiglass paper knife, scratched himself behind the ear with it, and spoke again.
Let's see. How long have you been pulling the wool over my eyes? 2 years, is it? And the plan allowed you 15 months, was it? When will the two prototypes be ready?
He shook his fist in warning.
No lies! I don't like lies!
This was the very question for which the three high-placed liars had prepared themselves when they learned that they were to appear together. Askolupov spoke first, as they had arranged. Bracing his shoulders as though to catapult himself at the all-powerful minister, and gazing triumphantly into his eyes, Askolupov said,
Comrade Minister, Comrade Colonel General.
Abakumov preferred this to Commissar General.
Permit me to assure you that the personnel of my department will spare no efforts. What do you think this is? A public meeting? What am I supposed to do with your efforts? Wrap my backside in them? I'm asking you for a date.
He took out a gold-nibbed fountain pen and aimed it at a 7-day calendar. Yakonov then intervened, according to plan, his subdued voice emphasizing that he spoke as a technician, not an administrator. Comrade Minister, within a frequency range of up to 2,400 hertz, at an average transmission level of 0.9 nipers...
Hertz, hertz, hertz. That's all I ever get from you. 0.9 hertz. Might as well be the square root of zilch. I want those instruments. 2 of them. Whole ones. When do I get them, eh?
He eyed the three of them in turn. Selivanovsky now took the floor, speaking slowly, stroking his grey and white crew cut.
May I inquire what exactly you have in mind, Viktor Semyonovich? Two-way conversations can't yet be perfectly encoded.
The minister shot him a glance.
Do you take me for an idiot? What's it mean, can't be encoded?
15 years ago, when Abakumov was not a minister, and neither he nor anyone else foresaw that he ever would be, he was in fact a sergeant major in the NKVD, being a big, strapping fellow with long arms and legs. His 4 years of elementary education had sufficed. He sought to improve his qualifications only in jiu-jitsu. All his training was done in the gymnasiums of the Dynamo Sports Club. Then, in the years when the ranks of the interrogation service were drastically thinned, while the need for interrogators grew just as rapidly, Abakumov was found to have a talent for the job, his long arms making deft and damaging contact with a prisoner's ugly mug. That was the beginning of a great career. Within 7 years he was head of the counter-espionage agency SMERSH. Now he was a minister, and not once in his steep ascent had he felt undereducated. And even here, at the top of the tree, he was too shrewd to be bamboozled by subordinates. Abakumov was getting angry, and was about to bring down on his desk a clenched fist the size of a cobblestone, when the high door opened and Mikhail Dmitrievich Ryumin came in without knocking. Ryumin was a short, rotund cherub with nice rosy cheeks, whom everyone in the ministry called Minka. Few of them, however, to his face. He walked as noiselessly as a kitten. Drawing near, he turned his innocent, light eyes on those seated there, shook hands with Selivanovsky, who rose slightly from his chair, went to the side of the minister's desk, and, inclining his head and lightly stroking the grooved edge of the desktop with his plump little hands, purred reflectively,
"You know, Viktor Semyonovich, I think this is a job for Selivanovsky. We don't pay the special technical department for nothing, do we? Surely they can identify a voice from a tape? If they can't, we should send them all packing."
He smiled as sweetly as if he were offering a little girl chocolate, and gave each of the department's three representatives an affectionate look. Ryumin had lived for many years in complete obscurity as a bookkeeper in a consumer's cooperative in the Arkhangel Oblast. Oblast, a province or area, that serves as a sub-national administrative division of the state. A pink and puffy man with a peevish mouth, he had needled his ledger clerks with every malicious remark he could think of, sucked fruit drops incessantly, and offered them to the warehouse manager, talked to truck drivers diplomatically, to cart drivers arrogantly, and submitted documents for the chairman's signature on time. But during the war he had been drafted into the Navy and trained as a special department interrogator. That was where Ryumin had come into his own. He had eagerly and successfully mastered the art of the frame-up. Perhaps he had always had half an eye on this great advance. In fact, his zeal had once proved excessive. He had concocted such a crude case against a newspaper correspondent attached to the Northern Fleet that the prosecutor's office, always so subservient to the organs, balked, and did not, of course, put a stop to it, but did get up the nerve to alert Abakumov. Abakumov summoned the little smirch investigator to discipline him. He entered the office timidly, expecting to lose his bulbous head. The door closed. When it opened again an hour later, Ryumin emerged full of importance, henceforth senior investigator of special cases at Smirsch headquarters. His star had risen steadily ever since, ominously for Abakumov, but neither of them knew that as yet.
"I'll send the lot of them packing anyway, Mikhail Dmitrich. Believe you me, when I've finished with them, they'll wonder what hit them," Abakumov said, looking angrily at all three.
They lowered their eyes guiltily.
"But," Abakumov went on, "I just don't understand. I mean, how can you identify somebody from a voice over the telephone? An unknown person. Where do you start looking?"
"Well, I'll give these three the taped call. They can play about with it and compare it."
"You mean you've made an arrest?"
"What do you think?" Ryumin said with his sweet smile. "Four men were picked up near the Sokolniki metro station."
A shadow flitted over his face. He knew in his own mind that by the time they were picked up, it was too late. But once arrested, they couldn't just be released. One of them might have to be processed so that the case would not remain officially unsolved. There was a hint of irritation in Ryumin's obsequious voice.
"What's more, I'll tape half the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for them if you like. But that would be overdoing it. We need only pick one of the five or perhaps seven people in the ministry who could have the information."
Abakumov was indignant.
"So arrest every one of the bastards. Why beat your brains out over it? What are seven people? Ours is a big country. We won't run out of population."
"Can't be done, Viktor Semyonovich,"
Ryumin replied judiciously.
"The foreign ministry isn't like the Ministry of the Food Industry. That way we would lose the trail completely, and besides, somebody in one of the embassies might skip out and join the non-returners. We simply have to find out exactly who it was, and as quickly as possible."
Abakumov said thoughtfully.
"Only I don't understand what we're comparing with what."
"One tape with another."
"One tape with another. Right. You think you'll have the know-how sometime, Selivanovsky?"
"I still don't understand what this is all about, Viktor Semyonovich."
"What is there to understand? There's nothing hard about it. Some bastard, some dirty rat, probably a diplomat, otherwise he would have had no means of knowing about it, called the American Embassy from a phone booth and ratted out our intelligence agents over there. It has to do with the atom bomb. Finger him, and you'll be a hero."
Selivanovsky looked past Askolupov at Yakonov. Yakonov met his gaze and raised his eyebrows slightly. This was intended to mean that the whole thing was unprecedented, that the methodology did not exist, that they had no background, that they had enough to worry about as it was, that they should leave this alone. Selivanovsky was intelligent enough to understand this twitch of Yakonov's eyebrows and the whole situation, and was preparing to muddy the waters. But Fomo Gurionovich Askolupov had been doing some thinking of his own. As head of department, he was determined not to be a mere figurehead. Since his appointment to that post, he had become more and more convinced of his superior merits, and he fully believed that he could master all the department's problems and solve them more easily than anyone else. Otherwise, he would not have been appointed. Although he had only an elementary education, he could not entertain the idea that any subordinate of his could understand their business better than he, except perhaps for matters of detail or situations where some minor adjustment was needed. He had recently been at a first-class health resort, where he had worn civilian dress instead of uniform and had passed himself off as a professor of electronics. He had met there the eminent writer Kazakievich, who had not been able to take his eyes off him. Kazakievich kept taking notes and said that in Fomo Gurionovich he had found the model for his portrait of a modern scientist. After this stay in the sanatorium, Fomo felt every inch a scientist. On this occasion, too, he understood the problem instantly and took the bit between his teeth.
"Comrade Minister, of course we can do it."
Selivanovsky looked round at him in surprise.
"Which establishment can we do it in? Which laboratory?" he asked.
"The telephone lab at Morfino. You said it's a telephone call, didn't you? Right then."
"But Morfino is working on a more important assignment."
"Never mind. We'll find somebody to do it. There are 300 people there. Surely we can find somebody."
He stared with dog-like eagerness at the minister. Abakumov didn't quite smile, but his face again expressed approval of the general. He had been just the same on his way up.
"Show me the enemy and I'll smash him to pulp. We all like juniors who resemble ourselves." "Good man," he said approvingly. "That's the way to look at it. The state's interests are what matter. Everything else is secondary. Right?" "Precisely, Comrade Minister. Precisely, Comrade Colonel General."
Ryumin was apparently not at all surprised or impressed by the selfless dedication of the pockmarked Major General. With a casual glance at Selivanovsky, he said,
"I'll come and see you tomorrow, then."
He exchanged a look with Abakumov and left the room, treading softly. The minister explored his teeth with a finger, removing remnants of the meat he had eaten for supper.
"Well, then, what is it going to be? You've led me on long enough. To begin with, it was the 1st of August, then it was the October holiday, then the New Year. What about it?"
He looked hard at Yakonov, forcing him to answer for himself. Yakonov seemed to have difficulty in finding a comfortable position for his neck. He bent it slightly to the right, then slightly to the left. He raised his chilly blue eyes to look at the minister, and then lowered them again. Yakonov knew that he was very clever. Yakonov knew, too, that people even cleverer than himself, people whose minds were on their work for 14 hours a day, all year round, with not a single day off, were concentrating on that accursed contrivance. The recklessly generous Americans, who publicized their inventions in generally available journals, were also indirectly participating. Yakonov knew as well the thousands of difficulties already overcome and the fresh ones through which his engineers were struggling like swimmers in a heavy sea. Yes, the very last of the absolutely final deadlines for which they had pleaded with this lump of meat buttoned up in a tunic was only 6 days away. But they had been forced to plead for and agree to ridiculous deadlines, only because the Corypheus of Sciences had at the very beginning allowed a single year for what was really 10 years' work. Now they had agreed, in Selivanovsky's office, to ask for a reprieve of 10 days. They would promise 2 prototypes of the telephone device by January the 10th. This was what the deputy minister had insisted on, and what Askolupov wanted. Their intention was to produce something, half-finished but freshly painted. For the time being, nobody would test, indeed nobody would know how to test, the absolute reliability of the coding. Before it reached the stage of serial production, and before sets were dispatched to Soviet embassies abroad, another half-year would have elapsed, and both the coding and the sound quality would have been put right. But Yakonov also knew that inanimate objects ignore deadlines set by men, and that what would emerge from the apparatus on January the 10th was not human speech, but gibberish. And what had befallen Mamurin would inevitably be repeated with Yakonov. The boss would call Beria in and ask, "What idiot made this machine? Get rid of him." And Yakonov would become at best another Iron Mask, but more probably an ordinary Zek once again. With the minister's eyes on him, he felt the noose tightening round his neck. He fought down his craven fear and blurted out as if gasping for breath, "Another month, just one more month, till February the 1st. He looked imploringly, almost dog-like, at Abakumov. Talented people are sometimes unfair to mediocrities. Abakumov was cleverer than Yakonov supposed. It was just that prolonged lack of exercise had rendered the minister's brain useless to him. His whole career had worked out in such a way that thinking had always brought setbacks, whereas zealous subordination had always brought gain. Abakumov therefore tried to avoid mental exertion as far as possible. He probably knew in his heart that 10 days or even a month would not help, when 2 years had already gone by. But in his eyes the blame rested on this trio of liars. Selivanovsky, Askolupov, and Yakonov had only themselves to blame. If the job was so difficult, why, when they took it on 23 months ago, had they agreed to a year? Why hadn't they asked for 3? He had forgotten that he himself had put them under merciless pressure. If they had dug their heels in with Abakumov, Abakumov would have dug his heels in with Stalin. They could have settled for 2 years and stretched it to 3. But the terror secreted in them during so many years of subjugation was so great that not one of them, then or now, had the courage to stand up to his superiors. Abakumov's own practice was to allow himself some leeway, and when he was dealing with Stalin, he always added a couple of months. On this occasion, Iosif Vissarionovich had been promised that one sample of a scrambler telephone would be placed before him by March the 1st, so that in the last resort they could be allowed an extra month, but it must really be a month and no more. Abakumov took up his fountain pen again and asked quite simply, "When you say a month, are you using ordinary human language or bullshitting again?" "Exactly 1 month. Exactly." Delighted by this happy outcome, Askolupov beamed as though he were eager to take off directly for Marfino and seize a soldering iron himself. Abakumov scribbled a note in his desk diary. "That's it, then. By the Lenin anniversary. You'll all get Stalin prizes. Selivanovsky, will it be ready?"
"It will. It will."
"Askolupov, I'll have your head, remember. Will it be ready?"
"Well, comrade minister, all it needs now is..." "What about you, Yakonov? You know what you stand to lose. Will it be ready?"
Yakonov stuck to his guns. 1 month. By February 1st.
"And if it isn't? Think about it, Colonel. Colonel, you're lying, aren't you?"
Of course he was lying. And of course he should have asked for 2 months. But what was done could not be undone.
"It'll be there, comrade minister," he promised miserably.
"Remember, I didn't put the words in your mouth. I can forgive anything, but not deception. Off you go now."
With lighter hearts they trooped out, as they had come, in single file, averting their eyes before the icon of the 5-meter Stalin. Their rejoicing was premature. They did not know that the minister had set a trap for them. As soon as they had been shown out, a new arrival was announced.
"Engineer Priantchikov,"